Okay, for those of you who wanted to hear Ann C. next week from San Diego, you're a week early because she's here tonight. She's here tonight. So I'd like to introduce you to Ann C.
Hi, everyone. My name's Ann, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Mike and John, for inviting me and showing me around. It's an honor and a privilege to be asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. Happy birthday to the four birthday recipients. And if anyone's new here tonight and did not identify, I want to welcome you because that was my story. I did not want attention on me. I didn't really want to be here, but I had nowhere else to go. And my sobriety date is May 29th, 2004. My sponsor's name is Karen. My home group's Old Town Speakers tomorrow night at 7 in Mission Valley. I have a commitment in that meeting, and I'm there every week unless I'm out of town or sick, which I'm usually there. So I'm going to share with you in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. I was born and raised in Iowa. I'm the oldest of three kids. I have two younger brothers, a mom and a dad, and neither one of my parents were alcoholic. I did not know what alcoholism was. And my parents were from North Carolina. We moved to Iowa because of my dad's career. And so I wasn't around their extended family growing up. And my mom's dad was alcoholic, and he died at 42 from delirium tremens. That's what it says on his death certificate. And that's all I knew about that. And so my father had mental illness, and sometimes he was medicated and sometimes he wasn't. And so my home life was a little bit unpredictable. I'll just say it like that. But we were not allowed to talk about it because my dad was a medical professional, and we had to not talk about that and keep it a secret. So from a very early age, I was keeping secrets, and I was scared, and I felt nervous. And that's not why I'm alcoholic, but I felt very fearful, a lot of self-centered fear growing up, unsure of myself. My earliest memories, like being on the kindergarten playground, I would watch kids talk to each other, and I didn't understand how you just naturally spoke to people. I was like, how did you know what words to say right then? And I mean, I was just really overthinking. And so by the time I had my first drink, I was in eighth grade. My parents had gone away for their anniversary. Their anniversary was May 29th also, so the first day I drank is the same as my sobriety date, just 14 years apart. And so I think maybe 15. I'm not really sure. I'd have to do the math. I'm a summer birthday, you know, I was young during school. But anyway, it was May. My parents went away, and I was supposed to be watching my two little brothers. And one of my brothers is almost 10 years younger than me, so he was about four, you know. And I thought I was stealing my parents' booze, but I found out later I stole my dad's employer's booze because they had had a party. And there was a bottle of Jose Cuervo in the basement, unopened. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. And I opened the bottle, and I had two eighth grade boys over and an eighth grade girl over. And I just knew I wanted to have fun and be up to no good. I wasn't realizing I was alcoholic. And so, because I hadn't really drank like that before, and I took that first drink, and I just, all that self-centered fear and angst, and like, do you like me? Do I look okay? Do I know what to say? I'm so weird. Why am I thinking so much? You know, it just calmed it down. And I was like, and then we passed it around a little more, and I got warm, and I was smiling, and I was happy, and I was present. And this kind of quieted down where I could be with my friends. And then I engaged in some inappropriate behavior for an eighth grade girl. And then it was 4 a.m. Oh, no, I had a thought before that. I thought, these boys are going to drink my booze, and they can get their own. And I locked myself in the guest room, and I drank the rest. And I was a skinny little eighth grader, and I went into a blackout and passed out. Came to on the top floor of the house. They were gone. Bottles missing. Brothers are alive, so that's fine. And I was like, I didn't know what happened, and I was very nervous. Basically, did I get away with this, or am I in big trouble? Because I grew up in the late 70s and 80s, and I did not have the timeout dad or gentle parenting, you know. I got away with it. I was like, cool. And I wasn't like off to the races right at that very moment. I didn't become a daily drinker in eighth grade, but I drank on the weekends. And if you offered me anything else, I said thank you. And I not what is it, you know. And I never drank normal. The way I just told you I drank was going to be the way I drank alcohol. And I always gravitated towards hard liquor. I never had just one. I always wanted more. I didn't realize I had the phenomenon of craving. I also started spiritually seeking from the very first time I started drinking. Where I'm from in Iowa, they have a Maharishi University and Transcendental Meditation. And so when I was like eighth grade, I learned how to do Transcendental Meditation because of the family I was babysitting for. And I became a vegetarian. And then when I went to college, I was like going to churches and rubbing olive oil on walls and speaking in tongues and drinking at the same time. And, you know, I was always searching. I knew something was wrong. And so My parents got divorced probably, I think he was out of the house in ninth grade, and it was finalized my junior year, and that's when it was on for me, is when I got that driver's license and the disciplinarian left the place, and my mom was trying to raise two other kids, and it was on. And so what it looked like for me was I was a very good student. I was in sports. I was in dance team. I did volleyball. I did golf. I looked like the good girl on the outside. And I would go do my homework in class, and then I would go to the way too older boyfriend's apartment. He had his own apartment because he was an adult. And I would drink there all night, and they did all sorts of stuff. And I would drive home at 7 a.m. and start over. And I might have some Benadryl before high school, but I don't know why. I said I had allergies. And, you know, and then I would do the same thing again, day in and day out. My friends, you know, I had a couple little things. Not, they weren't little, but, you know, my mom had to get me from the police station here and there. You know, my friends would go to jail, stuff like that. And I would just suddenly get antisocial at a party in high school and leave, and the whole place would get busted by the police right after I left. And I was like, sorry, you know. And I'm going to grab my water real quick. My mom, I graduated high school with honors and went to the University of Iowa, and my mom was saying, you're a budding alcoholic, because some really demoralizing things had happened to me that I had shared with my sponsor when I did steps 4 and 5, and they happened more than once, because unconscious blonde girls at parties, things happen to them, you know, and they happened to me. And so she was telling me, you're a budding alcoholic, you need to watch your drinking, because I didn't hide it. I mean, I was just drunk. So, and I had friends, you know, little things like friends wouldn't want to be around me. They're like, you're either always high or always drunk. And I was like, whatever, you know. And I was more like, whatever. And so I went to Iowa, and I went from being a straight A student to 3 D's and an F that first semester, because I don't attend class or read books. I'm drinking every day. I'm at the bars in the morning. And, you know, I'm just a mess. And I get really in a dark place my sophomore year of college, and I want to end my life. And so I didn't get out of bed for a few months. I was having a rough time, and I went to the psychologist at the university, and they said I was in a sophomore slump. They didn't ask about my drinking. I didn't even think to talk about my drinking. Yeah, I thought I was doing it because I wanted to. I thought I was the girl who parties and has fun, even though it really, when I look at it, it really wasn't fun. I was fun for about 30 minutes. And then I was really drunk and not okay. And so I had some injuries from my drinking back then. And then I realized in 1998 when I barely graduated with college with like a 2-point-something GPA. And I realized that Iowa was the problem. And I got in my car and drove to San Diego in 1998. And I didn't have a cell phone. My parents weren't like, please stay. They were like, don't let the door hit you. And I stopped in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where I had some friends going to UNM, and I drank there. And then it got real weird there that night, so I got up and left the next day and got to Carlsbad, where my best friend, who lives in Chula Vista, actually, her uncle lived in Carlsbad, and she decided to stay out here. We both decided to stay in California, but she was already out here. And I didn't even take the bags out of the car, and we were at the bars, you know, first night. And I just continued to drink out here. And then I was out here for about a year, and I decided to go to more school because I thought I got to buckle down. I need a do-over. Let's buckle down. And I went back to school, and I got a degree and a job and an office and all those things. And that's not treatment for alcoholism either. And I ended up, it was right after 9/11, and I moved up to Orange County for work because it was hard for me to get a job here. I didn't really try, is the truth, but I because I was drinking every day. And so I moved to Orange County, and that was the beginning of the end of my drinking. And I would try to get through a work day, and I could not stop thinking about drinking. I was like, I need a drink. I hate this place. I'm going to move to Canada. I don't know why you think you can drink in Canada, but that was my thought process at work. And in my head, it'd be like 8 o'clock, 8:01, 8:01 in 20 seconds. And when I wasn't drinking, I was very physically sick. I did not realize I was withdrawing from alcohol every day. I didn't understand. I just thought my hangovers were getting worse. And I would sometimes have to throw up down the hall. I was shaky. I was very, very sick. And then as soon as I drank again, I felt better. And I would go across the street to the, there was a bar. I worked like in an industrial area, and there was like a random bar across the street. And I would go get some martinis to drive home on the 405. And I thought, and sometimes I could have a couple martinis and go home and finish drinking at home. And sometimes I couldn't get off that bar stool. And then I think the only reason I don't have a long laundry list of DUIs is because that 405 was always full of traffic and you could not move. And I could have killed someone, though, how impaired I was driving on those freeways up there in LA and Orange County. And anyway, so I made a fool out of myself at our office's little holiday party. It got brought up in my review in front of everyone. And I was coming unglued at work. People were talking about how I smelled like alcohol. They're like, did you tie one on last night? Because I had vodka. I drank vodka. And I had vodka coming out of my pores. And they would talk about how bad I smelled. So I started putting the mango body butter on to try and smell like better. But I smelled like Citron. And then it was coming out of my pores. I drank every day. And I wasn't paying bills 1 month, you know, I was on the every other month payment plan. I couldn't keep it together. And I was coming unglued at work. I was screaming F-bombs. I was slamming phones, slamming doors in a place where you don't act like that. You're not supposed to. And I was getting called into the administrator's office. They're like, we like your work, but we think you need a psychiatrist. And I was like, you can't control me. And meanwhile, I'm controlled by King Alcohol. And I don't know it. And I was drinking mostly alone on the floor of my furnitureless apartment at the end. It was not cute. There was no party. And I would stay on the floor because I kept falling and getting physically injured. And my thought process was, you can't fall if you're already there. I just stayed on the floor. And my friend from school said, my one friend from school said, who lived in LA, said, hey, would you go out with me? I don't have any friends in LA and I want to go see this guy. And I said, okay. So I drank everything in my house. I drank everything in her house. We went to Woodland Hills. I drank everything in their house. And then we went to some club in, I think it was Hollywood. I don't know. And I remember the house lights came on. And the fact that I can remember this tells me I was not okay. And I ordered everyone a shot of vodka because I felt like the house lights came on too early. And nobody drank their shots, so I drank all the shots. And I had drank a lot of different stuff that night. And I started throwing. And I am not a fancy person. And we were with fancy people in a fancy car. And I start puking all over their car, and puking all over the 101. And this, it's hilarious to me that this is my moment of awareness of my drinking, because so many bad things happened to me that should have really been my wake-up calls. But for some reason, 27 years old, this still small voice inside of me says, nobody's throwing up in the car but you, Ann. And it wasn't new that I was throwing up. I just was around people. And I was embarrassed. And I was like, I can't act right, you know? And I got into my little Ford Focus. And my friend had to drive me home because I couldn't hold my head up, and I threw up all over that. And then when I traded it in sobriety, all the fabric was gone because of my stomach acid had eaten the fabric. I was like, I didn't even see it before because I don't ride in the passenger side. I'm the driver. And so anyway, that was the beginning of me trying to do what's in our book, Chapter 3, more about alcoholism, when it talks about trying to control and enjoy our drinking. And so I tried not to have, I tried to have Diet Cokes between my martinis because I thought, I'm just thirsty. It's a desert climate out here. And I never had a Diet Coke because once I put alcohol in my body wants more alcohol. A Diet Coke sounds like a stupid idea. And then I tried not to drink except for the weekends, and the weekends started on Thursday. And it was Monday, and I couldn't not drink on Monday, and I was sick on Tuesday, and it was Tuesday, and I couldn't not drink on Tuesday, and I was sick on Wednesday. And this went on for 6-7 more months. And I drove home in a blackout one last time. I had been at one of my boss's houses. I was in Long Beach, and my boss lived in Newport Beach. I worked in Santa Ana. And I drove home in a blackout one last time, and the only thing I remember is, like, my car almost hit the driveway or the garage door. I was renting a room from a friend because I couldn't pay my bills, and I had to move in with a friend, the same friend I told you about before, and my only friend out here. So, and I almost hit the garage, and I came to the next day, and that was May 29th, 2004, and I said, I can't do this anymore. And it wasn't I'm coming to AA. It wasn't I'm getting sober. I said, I can't keep living this way. And what happens to me is I don't go to Alcoholics Anonymous for 6 weeks. I detox at home. I think I'm going crazy. My Aunt Donna was sober 20 years at the time, and one of my bosses was sober in AA 20 years, Steve. He lets me say his name. And prior to me getting sober, a secretary who was sober in AA for 5 years, Steve's secretary, said, Steve's sober in AA. And I was like, aren't you supposed to be anonymous? Like, why are you telling me that? And I realized now they're trying to help me, but I didn't get it at the time. And so my Aunt Donna, I met a year before I got sober. She lived in Hawaii. She was calling me outside the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous during those 6 weeks, saying normal drinkers don't go into a blackout every time they drink. And I'm like, well, you would if you drank as much booze as I do. And my alcoholic life was my normal life. And so I didn't sleep very much those 6 weeks. I didn't sleep very much my first few months of sobriety. I was having racing thoughts. My legs were doing this on the fitted sheet, and I was sweating more than I've ever sweated in my life, and my heart felt like it was racing, and I thought I was going crazy. I realized I was withdrawing from alcohol, but I didn't know that at the time, and I thought, well, maybe I have what my dad has, and I need to go to a psych hospital, you know? And I did not know what was happening, and I thought that stopping physically drinking would make me better, and I was very bloated. My cheeks were like splotchy and red. My eyes were starting to yellow. My liver enzymes were elevated because I'd been to the doctor because I couldn't move my arm, and I finally told him how much I drank, and he said it was because I kept passing out like this with my arm bent, and that resolved itself, I looked bad, and I was like, well, I used to be able to say 30 pounds, but now we'll say 20 pounds more than I am now. And just from not drinking, I physically shrunk, like the bloat went away. But what happened to me during that 6 weeks, my aunt's calling me every day, trying to 12-step me, is that I thought taking away alcohol would make me feel better, and it didn't. It made it worse. Because I have untreated alcoholism now. I don't have the solution of booze, and I don't have the solution of AA. And I came to the conclusion, I began to cry every night, that I can't drink and I can't not drink. And I didn't realize that was in a vision for you in the big book, because I didn't have a big book, you know? And I thought, I'm going to have to end my life. And I had a plan to get a gun, because I used to check out in the gun aisle at Walmart, acting like, just because I didn't want to wait in line. And anyway, so that was my plan. And my boss, Steve, saw that I physically looked different just from not drinking, but I had a end my life plan, and that I wasn't talking about to anyone. And he goes, Ann, you look different. What's going on? And my coworker Gary came out of his office. He goes, that's because Ann stopped drinking. And I was like, I was, you know, restless, irritable, discontent, full of rage, whatever you want to call it. And I was crispy, and I didn't want to drink, but I didn't want to live. And I don't know how many days it was. It may have been less than a week. Steve came into my office, and it was one alcoholic talking to another. And he told me about his death march into Alcoholics Anonymous. He got sober up in Santa Barbara. And he said, you know, Ann, this might be the only window in the cosmos for you to get sober. And I suggest you walk through it. And I believed him with everything in my being, because I had had those experiments I tried. And I had tried other, you know, all the exercise and religion, and nothing's wrong with those things. They just didn't treat my alcoholism at the time. And so he said, why don't you listen to this CD? Because I did actually have to go to Santa Barbara the next day for work. And I thought it was music. I didn't realize it was an AA speaker. And it was Sister Maurice from the Bronx. And I laughed and I cried. I didn't realize I was identifying with a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. She said, Alcoholics Anonymous taught her to let thine own self be true really means, and to love thy neighbor as thyself, not instead of thyself. And for some reason, those things really resonated with me. And I brought it back to Steve the next day. I said, here you go, Steve. I'm like, can I have another CD? I'll stay sober by CD. I don't have to go to your meetings. Because I just thought, I will tell you, in my head at the time, I thought I had the beginnings of a possible drinking problem. That's how delusional and cunning and baffling alcoholism is. I've been drinking every day for many years, and I'm sure there was a day or two I didn't. I mean, I would assume. I just don't remember it. But he goes, why don't you go to a meeting with my friend Lisa? And I said, okay. And I was at a beginner's meeting in Newport Beach at 15th and Balboa in a church, and I did not stand up and say I was alcoholic. I'm just visiting here. Thank you very much. And I remember people were very friendly and kind. And I was like, what's your problem? I was like, not happy. And people came up from the podium and they shared their experience, and they had different stories than I did. Some had been homeless, some had lost their children, some had finished a prison term. But I identified with what alcohol did to them and for them. And I wanted to identify with what Alcoholics Anonymous did to them and for them. And at that very first meeting, the back of my, I'll never forget this, all the hairs on the back of my neck stood straight up. And internally, I said, oh my gosh, I'm an alcoholic. That's what's been wrong with me my whole life. And then I thought, oh no, I'm an alcoholic. That means I have to go to these stupid meetings and take these stupid steps. I mean, that was just where I was at the time. And at the end of the meeting, Lisa bought me my first big book. And she said, meet me at this meeting tomorrow. And I followed her around for about 2 weeks in Orange County. And I eventually stood up and I said, I'm Ann and I'm an alcoholic. And I cried when I said it. And I thought, now I got to do something about it. And they said, you know, Ann, you live in Long Beach. We think you need to go to Bellflower on Monday night. I didn't know Bellflower from any other meeting. I've been going to small, intimate meetings. And they said, you need to ask for Karen or Johnny. And I'm like, does anyone have a last name? Like, I was such a snot. And I went to this gigantic speaker meeting in Bellflower with the longest greeting line I've ever seen in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I now know it's my friend Ron was the first person standing there. And I said, hey, I'm Ann. Is Lisa is Karen or Johnny here? And he's like, Karen's right there. And I walked up to Karen. I said, hey, Karen, I'm Ann. Lisa sent me. And she goes, do you have a sponsor? And I said, no. And she goes, I'm going to be your sponsor. Go get in the greeting line. I said, okay. And at the end of that, I don't remember that meeting. I think I was a little overwhelmed by the 200 plus people in the room. And at the end of the meeting, she said, call me at 7:30 in the morning. And I said, okay. And I've been calling her for 22 years every day at 7:30 in the morning. And I think I was 4 or 5 years sober. I said, do I have to call you every day? Like, I'm fine. She goes, if you want to quit, what's working? I was like, yeah. I was like, okay. And so, but she got sober in Ohio. She's like old school. And so I started calling her, and she told me to write a gratitude list and to read the 24-hour day book and tell her what my takeaway was from the meeting. And I had to go to meetings every day and get there early and stay late and reach my hand out to the newcomer. I felt like I was in a military drill, and it was the best thing to happen to me, whether I liked it or not. And if you're new in AA, I want you to know I did stuff when I didn't want to. I did stuff when I didn't feel like it. And I think that's a large part of why I got to stay sober, because even on Wednesday, as recently as Wednesday, I worked a long day and I didn't want to go to my book study for some reason. And my head was like, get in your car and you drive to that book study. I'm like, okay, Ann, let go. And I was so grateful I went. It was a great meeting. And I just can still get like that sometimes. And so she took me through the 12 steps as they're outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I found out in the last couple years, I had a nickname called Angry Ann. And because I was so angry when I was new, and I let you know it. And then Johnny gave me a nickname when I was a few months sober, and he's like, well, here she is, joy to the world. So I was joy to the world. And last time I was here with my sponsee Amy, when she shared a few months ago, I saw his name signed in there, and he's in the big meeting in the sky now, as a lot of you probably know. But anyway, so we did the steps. I did it not with a good attitude. I did it kicking and screaming, but I did them. And when I had to read her my fifth step on February 5th, 2005, I was scared out of my mind, and I fought with my sponsor. And I said, I don't trust you. I don't like you. I mean, I was like, and she was calling her sponsor saying, do I have to put up with this blank? And she came over and we got on our knees and we said the third step prayer, and I told her everything. And I had put some stuff on a very separate piece of paper in the back that I was never going to tell another human being in my life. And because it was stuff I did and it was bad. And I shared it with her and she didn't even react. I was like, oh. And I didn't like it. I didn't enjoy writing my fourth step. I felt I was re-experiencing a lot of bad stuff and resentment and stuff. But when we got done, I felt hope, because I saw all the same patterns over and over again. And I felt hope that I could not be that person on that paper, hope that I could change, hope that I could respond and react to life different from this, taking the steps and implementing them in my life here in AA and relying on a God I found here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so we went forward and we did 6 and 7 and the amends. And 6 and 7 for me are like lifelong steps. That anger did not go away when I put that bottle down. And I had to really practice. I would like stumble and fall and have to get back up and not flip off the bank teller. And, you know, just stumble and fall and get back up and make amends and apologize. And I mean, I just acted badly. And I was not raised to act that way. You know, I just had a hard time. And I don't do those things today. I can't remember the last time I acted out in public. And or private, really. So I made my amends. I owed a lot of money. Took me years to pay it back. I did that. I wasn't super excited about it, but it wasn't my money. It was their money. And now I enjoy a good credit rating, and it took me years. And I made direct amends to my mom. And one of the things I said, I apologize for X, Y, and Z. I was wrong. I'd like to know what I can do to make it right. If there's anything else I'm forgetting, please let me know that too. And she was like, she had a laundry list. She was ready. And then with my dad and I were estranged from one another. And that one was a little bit different. And she said, I want you to call your father and ask if you can start calling him at a day and time convenient for him. And I was like, no thanks. And we hadn't spoken to each other in a long time. And I had to get his number from someone. I didn't even have it. And it took me 3.5 months, and I got in a lot of emotional pain. And I'm either going to take the action to stay sober, or I'm going to go drink. And so I called my dad in the middle of the toothpaste aisle at Target. And I said, Dad, this is Ann. I was wondering if I could start calling you day and time. Can be for you okay? I was like, ugh. And he goes, I would love that. And, you know, in God's timing, because I had tried to approach my dad in my late teens, and he had a very different response, which is why I was scared to approach him. And so I started calling my dad every Saturday at 8 a.m. and leaving a voicemail, and he didn't return the call. And I did it for about 3 months, and then I told my sponsor, I said, hey, he obviously doesn't want to talk to me. Can I please stop doing this? And this is where really strong sponsorship comes into play. She says, it doesn't matter what he's doing. It matters what you're doing. Be consistent. And I didn't want to hear that. And so I kept calling, and very slowly, over a period of time, we formed a relationship. And then I started doing, he was in Oregon at one point, so I invited myself up to Oregon for Thanksgiving weekends, and we watch football and sit in the Lazy Boys and eat pizza and hang out and watch boxing. And then I would come back down here, and over time, a father was restored to her daughter. The daughter and daughter was restored to her father, and we were clean with each other, and we made amends to one another. I initiated and took the lead, but all the forgivenesses that needed to happen, because I was a bad daughter, and I cleaned up my side of the street. So that last year on April 29th, I got a phone call after I dropped my son off that my dad was going to die that day. And it was a shocking call, and he died from sepsis, and he died a few hours later, and I got the second call that he died. And then he died on a Tuesday. The funeral was that Sunday. My stepmom really scheduled it quick. And so I flew back to Iowa. I was able to eulogize my father and honor him. And I will tell you that had my sponsor not had those amends and that direction and me being willing to follow it, I would have had a much different grieving process. Because my grief is, I miss my talks with my dad and our silly text messages and joking around. And my dad was funny. But I just miss him. But I know he's at peace. I don't have regret or unfinished business with my dad. You know, we were current. And I started sponsoring women against my will when I was 6 months sober. I was going to panels. I've always done panels. I have one at Sharp Mesa Vista every month if anyone ever wants to go. I'm not trying to plug a panel, but I love panels. And I went to one at Little Step in, is that what it's called? Yeah, in Bellflower. And a woman had 8 days and I had 6 months. And she said, will you sponsor me? And I said, okay. And she couldn't read. So we got the big book on CD. I figured that out at the time. And we listened to it and read it together. And it was an honor to take her through the steps. And sponsoring women for me is like the biggest gift of my life, because they always help me more than I ever helped them. And being able, and I've only had one sponsor. So I literally just say, I'll take you through exactly how I was taken through, because I don't know any other way. And we go through the big book together. And thank you, Jen, for being here tonight. She gives me the privilege of sponsoring her. And I will say that I've always had a belief in God my whole life. I had an experience early on where my brother was missing for a period. He would have gotten home, but somebody forgot to get him. He was an 8-year-old boy in his little baseball uniform, and my dad found him walking up the median of a 4-lane highway. He would have made it home that night because he was almost home, but he had been missing for about 5 hours. And it was like if you had a baseball game like in San Diego downtown to here, like he was walking really far. And so, but I prayed to a God that night. I said, please bring my brother home. And I was like 10 and he came home. So that was like my first tangible experience of that little faith I had. And so I just felt that I had done so many things out there and lived in a way that was very ungodly and unbecoming of a woman, that I just felt like God wanted nothing to do with me. And so when I first got sober, the God I used was the group of Alcoholics Anonymous, group of drunks. And people in Bellflower stayed sober. There was a strong sponsorship ethic there. And I just said, these people can stay sober together. This is my higher power. And I would do the prayers at night. But then like 3.5 years sober, I was praying on my knees. Thank you for today. Thank you for keeping me sober before going to bed. And I thought, this is stupid. I'm praying to a bedspread. And I got into bed that night, and this still small voice inside of me said, you're sober, aren't you? And I was like, oh, yeah, I can't do that by myself. And I know that. And so it was that first little mustard seed of faith that I got. And then probably 11 years sober is how I remember it. I went from, you know, just praying and believing that God will work it out, but still feeling nervous about life and anxious and stressed out, to really trusting and letting go and calming down and letting life unfold, the good, the bad, the ugly. Because, you know, a few months, my dad died April 29th last year, and then on July 18th last year, my Aunt Donna, who 12-stepped me, passed away from cancer. So 2025 was not my favorite, but I actually was okay. I never once thought I was going to drink. I went to my meetings. I told what was going on, and I tried to be of service to other alcoholics, because both my dad and my aunt wouldn't want me wallowing around in self-pity and feeling bad and miss, you know, they'd say, get out there and help someone. Both of them would, you know, they'd be like, I'm fine, you know, I'm at peace. And so, but Alcoholics Anonymous introduced me to a higher power that I absolutely rely and trust in every day. And I came down to San Diego, like, I guess it's 14 years now. And I spoke it under the bridge on steps 4 and 5. And apparently my husband was in the room. I didn't know it. And he asked some question about, like, oh, step 4 in the 12 and 12 talks about forming a true partnership. And what's your experience with that? And I said, oh, if you're asking me if I'm single, the answer is yes. I think I said something really smart-alecky from the podium. And then I answered it normal. And then somebody played matchmaker weeks later, and we reluctantly dated through the help of our sponsors. And then I moved down here, and we got married, and I had my son. He just turned 10 on the 20th. And last time I was here sharing, was I was 8.5 months pregnant with him. And that's not treatment for alcoholism either, having a husband or kids. I love my family, but I have to continue to do Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I moved to San Diego with 10 years, I felt like a newcomer again. With time. And so I had to like get commitments and get involved. And I will tell you, I'm not perfect at this, but I continue to do prayer and meditation every morning. I continue to help other women and go to the same meetings each week. And I have a peace inside of my soul that I never had before I got sober. And so if you're new or in your first year, I just want you to know Alcoholics Anonymous really works. And I have found that having a home group and a sponsor and taking the steps has given me a full and beautiful life. So thanks for letting me share.
Well, thank you, Anne. Appreciate that. Hope you come back and visit us soon and share with us again. Okay. I'd also like to thank the residents of the house and the Women's Auxiliary for the dinner served tonight. And if you'd like to circle us up and close us with the prayer of your choice, please.